This is News in No Time. Ed Gordon on today's roundtable, Bush's billions and little money for New York's finest. Joining us today to discuss these topics and more from our New York Bureau, Walter Fields, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com, E.R. Shipp, distinguished professor in journalism, Hofstra University School of Communication, and from Columbus, Georgia today, George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service. All right, folks, we just heard a conversation Farai had about trying to bridge the gap between the old and the new leadership, an age-old question. We thought we'd bring up an AP-AOL Black Voices poll that found when it came to asking African-Americans who their most important black leaders are, Jesse Jackson still leads the pack with 15%, 11% picked Condoleezza Rice, 8% picked Colin Powell, and 6% named Barack Obama. So Barack Obama being part of the new school, if you will, there, George Curry. When you take a look at this question of passing the torch and all, this is no different than we really saw in the 1960s.
No, and people shouldn't be confused about Condoleezza Rice or Colin Powell. They've had high-profile position, and they get that as a result of that. I don't know about the poll. There have been a lot of polls done about black leadership, and I don't know any that lead out Farrakhan and generally the head of Urban League and the NAACP as well. That's who people who generally recognize it. I don't think there's anything surprising about the poll at all, but there is always this tension between young and old, and that's why, at least during the height of the civil rights movement in 1960, it was important that young people have their own organization. SNCC was important to be there. It could be independent. These are the people who don't have mortgages. Some of them don't have families, and they feel freer. And I think for us to really return to our full vitality, you have to have, I think, a movement of young people to complement the other older.
E.R. Shipp, it wasn't the people on the top of the poll that interested me. It was the people on the bottom, if you will. Louis Farrakhan received 4%, Oprah Winfrey 3%, Martin Luther King Jr., assassinated in 1968, got 3%, Al Sharpton 2%.
Well, Ed, what upset me was not the rankings, but that we're giving that much attention and credence to the poll. It's who knows how many people actually subscribe to AOL who are people of color, black people in this case. Who knows how many of them took the time to answer those polling questions. So I think we give them too much credence.
Well, let me say let me answer those questions for you, though, E.R. According to Black Voices, AOL, and AP, 600 black adults were participants contacted
right,
by
were
phone.
Were they self-selected?
Contacted
was
by
it
phone.
A scientific poll?
Well, again, these are always questions of polls, but we do know that these were black
seriously.
Adults.
You could do
no, I'm being serious too. You can question any poll with issues like that, but pick up your point.
Okay, but you could do it scientifically, or you can just call your neighbors and ask them. So I don't know which version of this poll is, but my point was going to be this. What's the point of trying to figure out who's the HNIC in America these days? We don't need that. We need to focus on people who are doing serious work, contributing to various issues, and whether they are called a leader or whether they just happen to have a job and they're getting something done, that's more important than being HNIC.
For those that don't know, HNIC, sanitized version, head Negro in charge. All right, Walter Fields, talk about what E.R. just suggested there. Is there any credence, any importance in a poll like this?
I have always found these rankings to be suspect, including the Ebony list of top 100, where you had the grand poobah of Lodge 52 on the list every year. You know, I think one of the things we're trying to do is really put a square peg in a round hole. We're sort of using a 19th and 20th century construct of leadership for the 21st century. And I think if you remember the rankings back in the day, when you had people like Dr. King and Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young, the thing that was important to remember was that those individuals were attached to institutions. And what we have now is sort of this popularization of leadership. We have a cult of celebrity where people become leaders simply because of the celebrity factor. And what we're losing are institutions. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of people below the radar screen who are true leaders, who are really working to change communities in this country, who are never getting noticed because they're out of the public view. And I think we've got to begin the process of building institutions in our community and supporting individuals who are not necessarily celebrity leadership, but who are working hard on a day-to-day basis to try to improve conditions for our people. So this ranking does little for me, except once again, say we get caught up, I think, sometimes in too much in looking at, you know, the celebrity nature of who's on top and who's on bottom without really looking at the job that's being done in our community.
I agree with that. And I also think that when you go back to those Ebony ones, you know, for the longest, John Johnson wouldn't put Louis Farrakhan on there for political reasons. I think the important thing is that we do have leadership in place. We do have different organizations like the Black MBAs and the Black Lawyers and 100 Black Men that are performing leadership skills in our community. And we'll never get back to – see, there's a myth that we had one Black leader, that Dr. King was the only Black leader. It was never that way.
Dr. King was never even the Black leader.
Never that way.
Yeah.
And so we shouldn't be lulled into these nostalgic moments of saying, oh, back when the day when everybody rallied around Dr. King. Everybody did not rally around Dr. King. In fact,
this is true.
Did
not. You know what gets me? Periodically, I'm invited to go to forums where we're talking about the Black and Jewish relationship and how so many Jewish people came to the cause. And I say, I do thank those who did come, but not everybody who was Jewish came to the cause. Not everybody who was Black came to the cause. If everybody who now claims that they were on that Edmund Pettus Bridge was on that bridge, the bridge would have fallen down.
Right? And same thing,
but, you know, so people like to talk Kingsburg. About that.
All right. Well, you know what? I hate to say it, but people like lists. They like to say who is a leader.
Media like lists.
You all may not like this poll, but I think Americans like to engage in conversation like this, and they do want to know.
Oh, I think
who
you're right.
Is, quote, leading Black America.
I think you're right, Ed, but I think what it also does, it reduces us, because part of what I've always argued, I want someone to name the white leaders in America. Because, unfortunately, what we do is we tend to try to pigeonhole our people to suggest that there is this monolithic Black America that exists that you could actually have
right.
individuals who are the leaders of 35 million people. It's crazy.
Right.
And when they do the list of the top, you know, 10 white leaders, then I'd say, okay, then let's have a conversation. Because I'm not sure who those people are.
Well, they just don't label it as white, though, Walter. You know that. They'll say, who are the top 10 leaders in America, and we know what that means. And outside of Oprah maybe sneaking in to that list, it's going to be, you know, nine white folks.
But that's because I think they have a universal application of leadership, that they are saying that they are leaders, period. They're leaders of white folks, they're leaders of Black folks, they're leaders of anybody in America. I think some of our folks fit that category. I really do.
I don't think there's any question about that. But whether or not the majority of whites see that, I don't know.
So why don't we change the conversation then?
Well, we're about to.
Let's not let no.
Just in total, we're gonna get to something, ER. Since she didn't want to talk about this from the beginning, we're gonna get to something that
make them think of us in a different way.
All right, we're gonna get to something that clearly is important, and that is the president has asked for another $65 billion with a B dollars to fight this war, and note that that money would only take us through September 30. Congress is expected to approve this, George Curry, which will take us to nearly $400 billion for fighting a war in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And this is on top of a $2.8 trillion federal budget for 2007. You know, this is trickier in a way that you have these side deals or side proposals so the American public really doesn't understand how much we're spending or how, and they're really somehow not going to see this $115 billion. It should have been part of the budget so that we can really, America can see really where we are, and then they see that we're spending almost $6 billion a month on Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, just on Iraq and almost $900 million on Afghanistan, which is enormous numbers. And so they'll keep giving them the dollars, and they'll claim we don't have money. And now we're spending like this. We see why you don't have money.
Walter Fields, here's what's frightening to me. If you put that money on top of a separate request for almost $20 billion for new hurricane relief fund, and that'll take us to over $100 billion, someday, is going to have to pay for all of this.
Well, we're already paying for it. I mean, part of the problem on Capitol Hill is that the money is not real. I mean, we can print more money. And I think the problem in Congress is that Congress has always played with currency because they don't really have to deal with the repercussions. And I think what we're seeing is a further erosion of the checks and balances of our federal government. This Congress has laid down for this administration, and the problem is rooted in the initial authorization for this war, because they gave this president pretty much a blank check to do what he wants to do, including Democrats who voted for that authorization. So now we have a situation where you have this uncontrolled spending, and the American public has been dumbed down to the point that all the president has to do is say terrorism. And you see the poll numbers go up because they've convinced the American public that there is some link between what they are doing in Afghanistan and Iraq with some sort of war on terrorism, which there is not. So I think we've got a real problem here that we're going to continue to see the spending on top of Katrina, on top of everything else that's going on. They're bankrupting this country.
I think what's most important about what Walter just said is that we've kind of numbed the public so that when the president says terrorism or whatever, they come up with more money, whether you're Democrat or Republican. Democrats are going to hide behind the fact that they have voted to give the president the authority to come up with more money for the war. But that money means that you can say terrorism we're fighting, or you could say we're rebuilding New Orleans. But the point is, none of that is really happening. We're not succeeding, apparently, in the war against terrorism. And the after effects of Katrina are so obvious that you see that there are like thousands of mobile homes sitting there waiting for families to move into them. And they're falling apart because the federal government hasn't figured out how to connect the mobile homes to the people who need them. We're wasting money. And we're spinning our wheels and letting the president get away with making us think that we're doing something.
And
we're
the worst
not.
Part about this is extending the tax cuts. You know, we can't afford it. This is the only president in history that has extended tax cuts during wartime. If we have these kind of numbers, and we obviously do, it's irresponsible to give tax cuts that are going to primarily benefit the wealthy. That's unconscionable.
All right, let's take a look at a situation going on in New York City, but it really is reflective of police departments across this country. And that is, and this was a statement, I think, by this police officer. We've seen one police officer, a rookie, apply for food stamps in New York City. The suggestion here that the police union has signed off on a starting salary of just over $25,000 for a police recruit coming on board. We should note that that pay jumps to about $35,000 with uniform allowance, overtime, average first-year salary, et cetera, in about 6 months. Interesting here, Walter Fields, Mayor Bloomberg has chastised the union for accepting the pay cut for starting police officers.
Yeah, I really don't know what the mayor's motivations were in advising them on this public policy issue. I mean, in point of negotiation, I think it's to get the best deal possible. Each side is trying to get the best deal possible. But I think what we see here is something much larger, and it isn't just the police department. Public service employees, public sector employees have really become the working poor in many cities, particularly in New York. When you look at the cost of living, the cost of housing, which is really exorbitant in a place like New York, if you have this level of a salary, you're going to be forced in a situation of making some hard decisions. And some of those decisions truly are survival decisions, whether you eat or pay rent. And I think what we're seeing here is one of the reasons why the public sector, in terms of unionized employees, has shrunk so dramatically. Gone are the days in New York City where you had powerful unions like DC 37, yeah, 1199, a teachers union, able to get great concessions out of contract negotiations. They can't.
George, here's the interesting point when you talk about New York's finest and, quote, not paying them. When you look at how they were lauded during 9/11, it goes back to whether or not teachers are important in this nation. We don't pay them either.
We certainly don't, and I'm going to dissent here. I sympathize with, especially having lived in New York twice, that you need a lot of money just to live there. But $35,000 for a first-time job, with no experience, to me, is an out of line. I'm sorry. And if I'm gonna
but
give
that's
someone,
after six. Note that that's after 6 months overtime. That's your uniform allowance, et cetera, et cetera. The starting salary is $21,000.
Well, yeah, and that's comparable to a lot of other professions. I mean, you don't come in and join the middle class just because you're a policeman. I am far more concerned with the salaries of not that I'm not concerned here, but I'm far more concerned about inequities of salaries with what we pay our teachers and how we reward them and how we retain them.
ER-ship police officers would tell you, though, that they put their lives on the line, and because of that,
teachers
would
tell
quote,
you the same
combat
thing.
Pay.
Teachers
well, but
tell
not
you
the same way,
thing.
Though. Not in the but, same way. No,
from a different direction, teachers might say the same thing. So would firefighters. One of the things I noticed after the whole 9/11 tragedy was how many of those people who perished still lived at home with mom and dad. Mm-hmm. Still lived in basement apartments in a family home. They couldn't afford to go out on their own. But at the same time, somebody will get $20 million for doing a little cameo practically in a goofy movie that gets a zero rating. We have our priorities wrong in this society, and I think that's very clear. But I don't know how we're going to readjust those priorities. Yeah.
And along with, and in particular, the teacher salary is something that we've been debating, fighting, screaming about for a mighty long time. Walter Fields, E.R. Shipp, and George Curry, thank you very much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Right. Thank you.